Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. In March 2002, Randy Latona was living in paradise. The American businessman had traded Las Vegas for the Caribbean island of Roatan, Honduras, a place known for crystal clear water, coral reefs, and postcard-perfect sunsets. Shortly after starting a prominent rum business, Randy was found dead from a gunshot wound to the head. Authorities ruled it a suicide, but his family vehemently disagreed. The only other person inside the condo was his girlfriend, Leslie Spearing. Questions quickly surfaced about the scene, the investigation, and what really happened during Randy's final hours. Was this a tragic suicide or murder? Over the years, experts would reach dramatically different conclusions, turning this case into a mystery that remains unresolved to this day. Roatan, Honduras has a very special place in my heart. I've been there twice. The first time, I ended up living there for about 9 months after a difficult breakup. Looking back, it was one of the best periods of my life. I arrived carrying a lot of emotional baggage and uncertainty. I left with a completely different perspective. There's just something about Roatan. Maybe it's the water. Maybe it's the people. Maybe it's the pace of life. Or maybe it's all those things together. Roatan is the largest of Honduras Bay's islands, a narrow strip of land about 40 miles long floating in the Caribbean Sea, roughly 40 miles off the northern coast of Honduras. It's part of the second largest barrier reef system in the world, the Mesoamerican Barrier Reef, which stretches hundreds of miles through the Western Caribbean. For centuries, the island has been shaped by a fascinating mix of cultures. Indigenous peoples lived there long before European arrival. Pirates and privateers reportedly used the Bay Islands as hideouts during the 1600s, including legends involving the infamous pirate Henry Morgan. Later, British settlers arrived, and that influence is still there today. Even now, many island residents speak English as their first language alongside Spanish, giving Roatan a culture that feels distinctly different from mainland Honduras. Now, when people picture the Caribbean, they're usually imagining somewhere that looks a lot like Roatan. Turquoise water, palm trees swaying in the breeze, tiny fishing boats bobbing in the harbor, brightly painted buildings perched above the shoreline, the smell of grilled seafood drifting through the air. It's the kind of place where shoes become optional and schedules become suggestions. I spent my days there doing exactly what you'd expect someone escaping heartbreak to do. I laid on the beach and worked on my tan. I snorkeled every day. The water there is unbelievable. You don't have to be a diver to appreciate it. Sometimes you can walk straight off the beach and find yourself floating above coral reefs filled with tropical fish. One of my favorite things I did was rent a little motorbike and explore every corner of the island. And that's really the best way to see Roatan. You can drive from the more developed western side near West End and West Bay, where tourists gather for restaurants, bars, and diving excursions, all the way through quieter villages and jungle-covered hills toward the eastern end of the island, where life feels slower and more local. Every turn reveals something new. A hidden beach, a roadside fruit stand, a family-run restaurant, a breathtaking ocean overlook. I took boats through the mangrove tunnels, drifted through winding waterways that felt almost prehistoric. I visited nearby islands, hopped aboard water taxis, wandered through small towns, and spent afternoons exploring places with no particular destination in mind. But some of my favorite memories weren't the tourist attractions. There were those ordinary moments, buying groceries, cooking meals at my hostel, watching the sunset with people I'd just met days earlier, talking with locals about life on the island. Many of those people became lifelong friends. And that's one thing I think Roatan does exceptionally well. It's incredibly easy to meet people there. Travelers arrive planning to stay for a week and end up staying for months. Divers come for certification courses and never leave. Expats open small businesses. Locals welcome visitors into conversations. There's a sense of community that can be hard to find in larger tourist destinations. The culture itself feels relaxed and welcoming. People generally greet one another. Life isn't rushed. Family is important. Community is important. And respect is important. You quickly learn that things happen on island time. If you're expecting the speed and efficiency of the United States, you'll probably get frustrated. But if you're willing to slow down, you'll probably fall in love with the place. Today, most visitors come for scuba diving, snorkeling, fishing, boating, wildlife tours, zip lining, and beach vacations. West Bay Beach is often ranked among the most beautiful beaches in Central America, and the island has become a major stop for Caribbean cruise ships. Yet, despite the growth in tourism, much of Roatan still retains the charm that made people fall in love with it decades ago. And that's why Randy Latona's story feels so strange to me. Because when I think of Roatan, I think of healing. I think of freedom. I think of new beginnings. I think of one of the happiest times of my life. The island became a refuge for me when I needed one most. It's a place I'll always cherish. And now that I'm newly married, I can't wait to bring my husband there someday. Show him exactly why I fell in love with it. So I understand why Randy moved there. I understand why he thought he'd found paradise. I understand why he believed he could build a new life on that island. And when you know Roatan, it's hard to imagine a place so beautiful becoming the setting for such a tragic mystery. And before we dive into the mystery of what happened to Randy Latona, I think it's important to understand who Randy was as a person. Because when someone dies under suspicious circumstances, it's easy for their identity to become swallowed up by the questions surrounding their death. The headlines become about the investigation, the theories, the controversy, the arguments. But long before he became the subject of a mystery, Randy was a son, a brother, a businessman, and according to the people who loved him, someone who genuinely embraced life. Randy grew up in a close-knit family. His father, Vince Latona, was the head of a successful multi-million dollar engineering company. And Randy was raised alongside his siblings, Megan and David. Family members would later describe him as the classic California surfer kid. Blonde hair, sun-kissed skin, and an easygoing personality that drew people to him. He wasn't known for being confrontational or aggressive. Quite the opposite. Friends and family described Randy as a gentle soul. The kind of person who laughed easily. The kind of person who was always planning his next adventure. The kind of person who seemed genuinely excited about what the future might hold. And Randy wasn't someone who sat still for very long. He had an entrepreneurial streak and a restless curiosity about the world. By the late 1990s and early 2000s, he had become a successful stock trader living in Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, on paper, he was doing well. He had built a lucrative career and enjoyed a lifestyle that many people would have been perfectly happy to keep. But Randy wasn't interested in spending the rest of his life staring at computer screens and market reports. He was chasing something bigger than money. He wanted freedom. He wanted sunshine. He wanted the feeling that he was building something of his own. And eventually, that dream led him hundreds of miles south into the Caribbean. In 2001, at just 34 years old, Randy made a decision that shocked many people around him. He closed his trading accounts, packed up his life, and moved to the island of Roatan. But this wasn't some impulsive midlife crisis. Randy believed he had found an incredible business opportunity. He envisioned a company called the Bay Island Rum Company, a venture that would distribute Caribbean rum products throughout Central America. The sources indicate he invested heavily in the project, importing roughly $30,000 worth of materials, renting warehouse space on the island, and building relationships with hotels, gift shops, and local businesses. Now, by all accounts, the business was beginning to gain traction. His products were appearing throughout Roatan, and Randy was optimistic about the future. For Randy, Roatan wasn't just a place to live. It was a fresh start. But while his business was growing, his personal life was becoming increasingly complicated. For nearly 8 years, Randy had been involved in an on-again, off-again relationship with Leslie Spearing. Now, when Randy first introduced Leslie to his family, they say she struck them as shy. Yet, even from the beginning, they felt uneasy. In later interviews, family members admitted they didn't have a favorable first impression. They described her as withdrawn, rough around the edges, and someone they struggled to connect with. But they also recognized that Randy clearly saw something in her that they didn't. Whatever concerns they may have had, Randy genuinely loved her. He kept returning to the relationship, even as it became increasingly turbulent. Now, Randy's family would later claim that Leslie became financially dependent on him and that the relationship was marked by dramatic ups and downs. They alleged that she was struggling with cocaine addiction and that her behavior could swing from affectionate to explosive. Now, these claims came primarily from Randy's family and should be understood as allegations rather than established fact. Leslie has disputed many of the accusations made about her over the years. Now, at the same time, records indicate that the relationship may have been more volatile than Randy's family acknowledged. Public records show that Randy himself was arrested twice in the United States following allegations that he assaulted Leslie. He was never charged, and the circumstances surrounding those incidents remain unclear. But those records suggest a relationship that may have involved conflict from multiple directions rather than a simple victim and villain narrative. By early 2002, however, something appeared to have changed. Randy's business was on the verge of a major promotional push. Easter week was approaching, one of the busiest periods of the year on Roatan. Thousands of visitors would be arriving on the island, and Randy was preparing a significant marketing campaign for the Bay Island Rum Company. Family members later said he was excited, energized, and focused on the future. And after the holiday festivities ended, he planned to fly back to the United States and spend Easter with his family in upstate New York. And according to those closest to him, Randy had made another important life decision. After years of turbulence, he was ready to end his relationship with Leslie once and for all. His family would later claim that Randy had finally reached his limit. They say he told her there would be no more money, no more second chances, and no more reconciliation. According to their account, Randy's message was blunt. "This is it. There's no more. I'm not giving you any more money. You're not going to stay here. You're done. We're done. You're out." Now, whether that conversation happened exactly as described is impossible to know. But if it did, it would mean that in the days leading up to his death, Randy believed he was standing on the edge of a brand new chapter. His company was growing. He had plans to see his family. He was looking toward the future. But within days, he would be dead. The question that has haunted this case ever since is whether Randy's future was suddenly taken from him, or whether something else happened inside that condominium overlooking the Caribbean Sea. But whatever happened during those final hours would spark more than 2 decades of questions, accusations, lawsuits, and competing theories. To understand why so many people still debate Randy's death today, we have to go back to the very beginning, to the last known days of his life, and the events that unfolded on Roatan during Easter weekend. As March 2002 came to a close, life seemed to be falling into place for Randy Latona. He was living in the Caribbean island of Roatan. His Bay Island Rum Company was beginning to gain momentum, and he was preparing for a visit with family for the Easter holiday. Instead, Easter morning would become one of the worst days for his family. Thousands of miles away in New York, Vince Latona checked his cell phone and found a voicemail waiting for him. The message was brief. "This is a neighbor of Randy's in Roatan. Something has happened, and you need to contact us as soon as possible." No explanation, no details. Just a message that instantly told a father something was terribly wrong. Imagine getting a voicemail like that. Your son is in another country. You have no idea what's happened. No idea if he's hurt. No idea if he's alive. Only that something is wrong. Very, very wrong. As panic set in, Randy's sister Megan immediately called Roatan, desperate for answers. She asked to speak to her brother. The response she received was chilling, that she couldn't. And in that moment, the nightmare began. What the Latona family would soon learn was that Randy had been found dead in his condominium. According to Honduran authorities, Randy was discovered lying on his bed with a single gunshot wound to the head. A 9mm Glock pistol was found in his right hand. Investigators noted that his thumb was wrapped around the trigger. Now, one of the first people to arrive at the scene was the condominium manager, Antonio Moncada. Years later, Antonio recalled immediately recognizing that Randy was beyond help. There was blood on the bed, a dark, dried trail near Randy's ear. He said the blood had already turned dark brown. To him, it was obvious that Randy had been dead for quite some time before anyone arrived. The scene appeared quiet, still, frozen in time. And yet, what had happened inside that room during the previous hours would soon become the subject of fierce debate. Investigators from Honduras processed the scene and conducted a forensic examination. Their conclusion was straightforward. Randy Latona had died by suicide. For local authorities, the case appeared relatively simple. A man alone in his bedroom, a gunshot wound to the head, a firearm in his hand, case closed. But for Randy's family, the ruling raised more questions than it answered. Almost immediately, Vince Latona rejected the conclusion, and so did Randy's mother, Jill. They couldn't reconcile the ruling with the son they knew. Now, this was a man who had been planning business promotions, making future travel plans, preparing to visit his family, talking about what came next. And now, investigators were telling them that Randy had chosen to end his life. Well, his family just wasn't buying it. One of the first things that stood out to them was the absence of a suicide note. No letter, no explanation, no goodbye. Nothing that suggested Randy had intended to die that day. Jill's reaction was immediate and unwavering. "I don't care what they say, he did not take his own life." It's a statement that would define everything that followed. Because from that moment forward, two very different stories emerged. One story was the official version. A successful businessman was depressed and took his own life. The other was the version Randy's family believed, that something happened inside that condo in the early morning hours of March 30th, 2002. Something that investigators had missed, or perhaps never fully examined. And as the Latona family began digging into the details, they would uncover questions about the crime scene, the timeline, the forensic evidence, and the person who Randy was with during his final hours. Questions that would eventually lead to private investigators, forensic experts, a wrongful death lawsuit, and a mystery that remains debated more than 20 years later. Because if Randy didn't commit suicide, then someone has never told the full story of what happened that morning on the island of Roatan. What happened after Randy's death would consume his family for years. Because while Honduran authorities believed they had solved the case, Randy's parents believed the investigation had barely begun. Now, almost immediately after learning of their son's death, Vince and Jill Latona became convinced that Randy had not taken his own life. In their minds, the person who held the answers was the one who had been with him during his final hours. And that was his longtime girlfriend, Leslie Spearing. The Latonas believed that Randy had finally ended the relationship. After years of breaking up and getting back together, they thought Leslie realized that this time was different. Randy was preparing to leave Roatan, visit his family for Easter, and move forward with his life. According to the family's theory, the confrontation that followed turned deadly. And Leslie, however, told a very different story. After Randy's death, she gave a statement to Honduran police that was ultimately cleared of wrongdoing by investigators. According to Leslie, she had spent the evening before Randy's death partying in a nearby town and using cocaine. She told police she didn't return to the condo until the early morning hours. When she arrived, Randy was awake. She said the two spoke briefly and then went to bed. Hours later, Leslie claimed she awoke to find Randy dead beside her. Perhaps the most controversial aspect of her account was her assertion that she never heard the gunshot that killed him. She said she slept through it. Then that detail would become one of the most fiercely debated elements of the entire case. Leslie also told investigators that Randy had been struggling emotionally in the days before his death. According to her statement, he had been drinking heavily. He had not left the apartment for several days, was not taking care of himself, and appeared depressed. She also stated that Randy occasionally used cocaine. In Leslie's view, the evidence pointed toward suicide, and Honduran investigators agreed. Investigators Rafael Soto and Gonzalo Sanchez publicly stood by their findings, stating they were certain Randy had committed suicide. To them, the physical evidence supported that conclusion, and they viewed the family's objections as a common reaction to a tragic loss. But for Vince Latona, those conclusions only strengthened his resolve. He couldn't accept them, and he wasn't willing to let the case end there. What followed was a years-long crusade by a grieving father determined to prove that investigators had gotten it wrong. Vince poured enormous amounts of time, money, and emotional energy into the case. He traveled repeatedly to Honduras. He spent more than $100,000 pursuing additional evidence. What had begun as grief became a mission, a full-time pursuit of answers. And one of the people he hired was veteran prosecutor Wayne Hollingsworth, a respected former Maine prosecutor known for handling difficult cases. After reviewing the evidence and conducting his own investigation, Hollingsworth reached a dramatically different conclusion from Honduran authorities. He believed Randy's death was a homicide, not a suicide. While working on the island, Hollingsworth said he heard allegations from local residents that Leslie had threatened Randy in the days leading up to his death. Now, according to those accounts, she had allegedly told people at a local tiki bar that if she didn't get a ticket back to Los Angeles by Saturday, she was going to kill him. Those statements were never proven in court, but they became an important part of the family's theory of the case. Hollingsworth also focused on what he viewed as inconsistencies in Leslie's timeline. Most notably, he questioned the claim that someone could sleep through a gunshot fired inches away inside a bedroom. A 9mm Glock discharged near a person's head would be extraordinarily loud. To Hollingsworth, the idea that someone sleeping beside Randy would remain asleep seemed impossible. And quite honestly, it seems impossible to me as well. Then there was the blood evidence. Reviewing crime scene photographs, Hollingsworth argued that the flow of blood across the mattress appeared inconsistent with Leslie's claim that she had been lying beside Randy when the shooting occurred. In his interpretation, the blood should have been interrupted by another body on the bed. Instead, he believed the photographs suggest there was nothing between Randy and the opposite side of the mattress. Vince also retained Miami forensic pathologist Dr. Raul Vila. After reviewing the evidence, Dr. Vila likewise concluded that Randy's death appeared to be a homicide staged to resemble a suicide. He pointed to what he believed were inconsistencies between the crime scene and the official ruling. One piece of evidence that drew particular attention was a paraffin test that reportedly failed to detect gunshot residue on Randy's hand. To the family and their experts, that finding suggested someone else may have fired the weapon and then placed it in Randy's hand afterward. But not everyone agreed. Other experts reviewed the same evidence and reached very different conclusions. One specialist argued that Randy's grip on the gun was actually consistent with suicides and inconsistent with many staged scenes. According to that expert, people attempting to fake a suicide often simply place the weapon beside the victim's hand. Now, in Randy's case, the way the firearm was positioned appeared more natural. The expert also suggested that the lack of gunshot residue could potentially be explained by the close contact nature of the wound, with residue entering the wound itself rather than dispersing outward. Meanwhile, Honduran investigators pointed to other details supporting Leslie's account, including blood found on her clothing, which they believe corroborated her version of events. And then there was another problem. Leslie described Randy as depressed and potentially suicidal, but Randy's family didn't recognize that picture of him. His sister Megan later said she spoke with Randy only 2 days before his death and noticed nothing alarming. He seemed normal, optimistic. He seemed like himself. Now, in many ways, that's what makes this case so difficult. The same pieces of evidence have been interpreted in completely different ways by experienced investigators, forensic experts, and the people who loved Randy most. Was Leslie telling the truth? Did Randy secretly struggle with problems his family never saw? Did investigators correctly identify a suicide scene? Or did they overlook signs of something more sinister? Now, the Latonas became so frustrated that they eventually turned to the civil court system. In 2004, they filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Leslie Spearing. Their goal wasn't simple financial compensation. They hoped the lawsuit would force Leslie to answer questions under oath and provide information they believed had never been fully explored by investigators. According to reports, Leslie was served with the lawsuit but never responded, and the matter remained pending before a federal judge. And then, strangely, the public trail largely disappears. Despite extensive searching, no publicly available court records have surfaced showing a final judgment, trial, settlement, or dismissal. But as far as the public record goes, the ultimate outcome remains unclear. The only verifiable facts are that the lawsuit was filed and that it was still pending during news coverage in 2004. More than two decades later, Randy Latona's death remains suspended between two competing narratives. One says a troubled man took his own life. The other says a murder was disguised as a suicide. And somewhere between those two stories lies a truth that Randy's family spent years trying to uncover, but may never fully know. Now, whenever I cover a case like this, I think it's important to separate what we know from what we think we know. The truth is, more than 20 years later, nobody outside that condominium truly knows what happened during Randy Latona's final hours. What we have are theories. Some are supported by evidence. Some are supported by emotion. And some sit somewhere in the uncomfortable space between the two. Now, the first theory, the official ruling, is that Randy died by suicide. And according to Honduran investigators, the physical evidence at the scene supported that conclusion. And to be fair, it's important not to dismiss that possibility simply because Randy's family couldn't imagine it. One of the most difficult realities in death investigations is that loved ones don't always see someone's private struggles. People can hide depression remarkably well. Sometimes they make future plans. Sometimes they laugh and joke with family members days before taking their own lives. That does happen. But what gives me pause is that so much of the suicide theory depends on accepting Leslie's account of Randy's state of mind. And Randy's family strongly disagreed with that characterization. While none of that proves he wasn't depressed, it does make the picture more complicated. And then there's the second theory, the theory that Randy's family has spent decades believing that Randy was murdered. Specifically, that Leslie shot him after realizing he was finally ending their relationship. According to the Latonas, Randy had reached a breaking point. They believed he was finished supporting Leslie financially and told her that the relationship was over for good. Now, in their view, that created a motive. When you look at the timeline, you can understand why they became suspicious. A relationship that had lasted nearly 8 years, repeated breakups, reconciliations, financial dependence, arguments, a looming separation, and then Randy ends up dead. It's not hard to see why his parents looked at those facts and wondered if something more happened. And then there are the details that investigators and experts continue to debate. The blood evidence, the gunshot residue, the claim that Leslie slept through a gunshot fired inches from her head, the conflicting interpretations from forensic experts. And one side looks at those details and sees a staged suicide. The other sees a tragic but legitimate suicide scene. Now, what fascinates me about this case is that neither side has been able to completely eliminate the other. Usually, after enough time passes, a theory kind of starts to fall apart. Witnesses recant, evidence emerges, someone confesses. Something happens that pushes the case in one direction. But Randy's case never really did that. Instead, it became frozen in place. Two competing narratives, two groups of experts, and two completely different versions of reality. Now, there's also a third possibility that rarely gets discussed. Not because there's evidence for it, but because unsolved cases sometimes force us to consider uncomfortable alternatives. What if neither side has the complete story? What if there were details investigators never uncovered? Witnesses who never came forward? Events that occurred that night that nobody fully understood? I think sometimes we become so focused on choosing between theory A and theory B that we forget there may be information we simply don't have. And that makes this case frustrating. Because at its core, it's really not a story about a gun or a crime scene or forensic reports. It's a story about uncertainty. A father who spent years trying to prove his son was murdered. A mother who never accepted the official ruling. A sister who remembered the final conversations she had with her brother. A man who traveled to a Caribbean island chasing a dream, only to die before he ever got the chance to see where that dream might lead. Now, personally, after looking at this case, I find myself coming back to the same conclusion I often reach in mysteries like this. I don't know what happened to Randy Latona. And I don't think anyone can honestly say they know for certain. What I do know is that a family has spent more than 2 decades searching for answers they believe they never received. And whether Randy's death was a suicide, a homicide, or something more complicated than either side realizes, that unanswered question has become its own kind of tragedy. Because sometimes the hardest thing for a family to live with isn't knowing what happened, it's never knowing. Now, whenever I tell people I lived in Roatan for 9 months, one of the first questions they ask is, was it safe? And my answer is always the same, yes, but with an asterisk. Because Roatan is one of those places where it's surprisingly easy to stay safe, if you use common sense. And it's surprisingly easy to get yourself into trouble if you don't. Now, before I get on my safety soapbox, I should probably confess something. I have absolutely done stupid things while traveling, plenty of them. But one story from Roatan kind of takes the cake, so please don't tell my mom. When I was living on the island, I had a basic routine. I'd spend my days at the beach, snorkeling or exploring, and at night I'd often head to a local bar, listen to live music, have a few drinks, and then wander back to my hostel. That in itself is dangerous when traveling alone. But it gets worse. One night, after a few drinks, I met a local guy who told me he could take me snorkeling on his boat. And my immediate reaction wasn't, wow, this sounds like the opening scene of a true crime podcast. My immediate reaction was, that sounds awesome. Looking back, there were approximately 17 red flags. We had both been drinking. It was nighttime. We were going out on the ocean, in a foreign country, on a boat, alone. And he was a complete stranger. Now, naturally, I followed him to his boat, alone, because apparently my survival instincts were taking the night off. Now, at first, it was incredible. We got out on the water, shut off the motor, and slipped into the ocean. If you've never been in the Caribbean at night, it's hard to describe. Everything feels bigger, darker, more mysterious. The stars are endless. The water feels like you're floating through another world. And then another boat appeared. And suddenly, giant spotlights lit us up in the water. We surfaced to find several official-looking men yelling very fast in Spanish and carrying guns, which is generally not the energy you're hoping for during a relaxing snorkeling excursion. Now, it turned out they were essentially the Honduran Coast Guard. Apparently, they thought we were illegally diving for lobster at night, which carries serious fines and is heavily regulated. Thankfully, after a lot of explaining, everything turned out fine. Nobody went to jail, nobody got arrested, and I made it back safely to shore. But let this be a lesson. If a man you met an hour ago at a bar invites you to the middle of the Caribbean Sea at night, maybe take 5 seconds to think about it before saying yes. But that's not really a Roatan safety issue. That's a Jamie making questionable decisions issue. What I've learned about Roatan is that most of the safety risks visitors face aren't dramatically different from what you'd encounter in many tourist destinations around the world. The biggest problems tend to be alcohol, poor judgment, unfamiliar surroundings, petty theft, and taking risks you wouldn't take at home. Now, that's not to say Honduras doesn't have crime. It absolutely does. The U.S. State Department continues to advise travelers to exercise caution throughout Honduras because violent crime, armed robbery, kidnapping, and gang activity remains a problem in parts of the country. However, they specifically note that the Bay Islands, including Roatan, have a higher concentration of law enforcement resources and are generally better policed than many areas on the mainland. And that's an important distinction. When people hear Honduras, they're often thinking about crime statistics from major mainland cities. Roatan is very different. The island's economy depends heavily on tourism, so protecting that industry is a priority there. Dive shops, restaurants, hotels, fishing charters, water taxis, tour operators, everyone has a vested interest in keeping visitors safe and coming back. Of course, that doesn't mean crime never happens. Visitors have reported occasional thefts, pickpocketing, scams, and burglaries. Like anywhere, valuables left unattended can disappear. Alcohol-fueled fights happen. Tourists occasionally make poor decisions after too many drinks. But the reality is that most visitors spend their entire trip snorkeling, diving, eating seafood, riding water taxis, and watching sunsets without experiencing any crime at all. Personally, I felt safer walking around Roatan than I have in most parts of Los Angeles. Of course, I also wasn't wandering around with expensive jewelry hanging off me while waving cash around. And that's the key. The same rules that keep you safe almost anywhere work in Roatan too. Don't get excessively drunk around strangers. Don't flash money. Don't leave your phone unattended. Don't walk alone in unfamiliar areas at night. And don't get on random boats with men you met an hour earlier at a bar. Yes, I'm talking to myself on that one. I've also added a few Roatan-specific safety tips. If you're diving or snorkeling, go with reputable operators. Watch ocean conditions carefully. The reef is beautiful, but currents can be stronger than they appear. Use reef-safe sunscreen. Stay hydrated. And if you're renting a scooter or motorbike, which I absolutely love doing, take it seriously. Honestly, I saw more tourists get injured on scooters than from crime. The roads can be steep, winding, and unpredictable. So wear a helmet. At the end of the day, my opinion is that Roatan remains one of the most beautiful, welcoming, and enjoyable places I've ever traveled. But paradise isn't magical protection against bad decisions. Whether you're in Honduras, Paris, Los Angeles, or anywhere in the world, most travel safety comes down to the same thing. Stay aware, trust your instincts, and have fun. But don't mistake being adventurous for being invincible. Because if you do, You may find yourself floating in the middle of the Caribbean at midnight while armed officers shine spotlights in your face. As I wrap up today's episode, I keep coming back to the image of Randy Latona arriving in Roatan. A guy with a dream. A guy willing to leave behind a successful career and take a chance on a completely different life. He wasn't chasing money anymore. He was chasing happiness. And for a while, it seemed like he found it. More than 20 years later, the debate over Randy's death continues. Some people believe the case was solved on day one. Others believe the truth was never fully uncovered. But regardless of what happened inside that condominium in March of 2002, one thing is certain. A family lost a son and a sibling. Friends lost someone they cared about. And a man who had big plans for the future never got the chance to see them through. If there's a lesson in Randy's story, I think it's this. Life can change in an instant. The people we love aren't guaranteed tomorrow. So tell them you love them. Take the trip. Make the phone call. Don't put off the things that matter. Because none of us knows how much time we have left. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod. And subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates. And even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.